it is a win-win-win. It's a win for the environment, it's a win for women, and it's a win for mitigating against climate change.
This is How to Stop Climate Change. I'm David Butler.
And I'm Keaton Butler. Today we'll be talking with Betsy Beamer Ferris,
Director of the Environmental and Sustainability Studies Program at the University of Kentucky.
We'll be talking with Betsy about the sustainable practice of seaweed farming on a Tanzanian island and how it's helping solve climate change. We'll hear about the time she spent in Tanzania trying to help fix the damaged environment and economy there with the natural resources that they have, and the importance of giving the people native to the area a voice in the matter.
So I do my research in Tanzania, which is in East Africa. It's known for the Serengeti and Kilimanjaro. And I've been working in Tanzania for 20 years, for half my life now. And my research is focused on conservation and management, coastal and marine mostly. And I am also really interested and do a lot of research on climate change policy and how it gets implemented and who gets to decide and what are the ramifications, what are the ecological justifications, is it actually going to work and why, and trying to get people who live on the coast of Tanzania who work with their environments every day in order to survive, to have them have a say in climate change policy so their voice can be integrated into the discussion. Because I think that if you work with the environment and you're experiencing climate change firsthand, you should be the one on the negotiating table talking about the solutions that you see fit. And it's a very under-recognized voice, particularly by women, and it's important to hear it and have it be researched heavily and promoted and integrated into policy.
One thing that has allowed Tanzania to put a stronger focus on combating climate change is actually help from Norway. Two words I don't think I've ever seen together are African Nordic, but it's true. Since 2007, Norway has allocated up to $3 billion a year of its aid budget to reducing emissions from deforestation and forest degradation in developing countries. And Tanzania is one of those countries.
In Tanzania, Norway is a major donor for the environment, and this is because of a socialist kind of legacy and partnership, and it's been wonderful to see Norway committed to providing funds for the environment. And so Norway is an important place in terms of climate change because they're one of the major global players. They've been donating the most amount of money around the world, and they're on the front lines of climate change policy and solutions. And so it's been interesting to work with and understand how Norwegian money is spent and in what ways and how it can be spent in a way that's benefits the environment, but also the people living in these places.
What do you think it is about Norway that makes them so proactive about donating money in the developing world, particularly around climate change?
Norway is one of the wealthiest countries in the world, and some people, especially in the United States, don't know why, and one of the reasons is oil. So they have an invested interest in addressing and dealing with climate change, given the impact that the country has had in the oil industry, which is remarkable because, you know, by comparison, the United States has a long way to go in terms of what we're doing to fight climate change and think about policy and building solutions across the country. I first went to Tanzania when I was 20 years old, and I had never been anywhere. So I had been to Myrtle Beach, basically. And I got on a plane and went to Tanzania and did a study abroad, and it changed my life because I saw the world for the first time. I was on the plane and was so excited that I actually thought when we landed in Dar es Salaam, which is on the coast and nowhere near a national park, I thought I saw a giraffe because I was so excited. It was actually a pole. But, you know, it changed my life because I saw a place of such immense beauty, right? It's gorgeous. It's, you know, got some of the wonders of the world. And also so much potential, such smart people who had just, you know, a warmth that I find is remarkable. So I started working there, and I first worked in the mountains, and then I moved to the coast. And the coast of Tanzania is quite fascinating. It's a heavily gendered space. And what I mean by that is that men in coastal Tanzania, they do the fishing and they are allowed to swim. And so they are in the open ocean in the deep water. And so the men along the coast go out to sea. They do all of the fishing, whereas the women have a very different role with the way that they use the environment. And so women are restricted to the intertidal zone, which is, you know, a space by which they can get to maybe by a boat, but mostly just by walking. And most women along the coast do not know how to swim. It's a predominantly Muslim area. And one of the reasons that they've told me that they work in the intertidal zone is not only because they don't know how to swim, but also because they are in charge of all of the reproductive work in the household. So they have to get fuel wood to cook their food. They have to take care of the children. They need to cook the meals. They need to cut the fuel wood. And it's an intensive, laborious job to do that. And so one of the ways in which they try to produce an income for the family is from seaweed farming. And so the specific place that I work in Tanzania is called the Mafia Island Marine Park.
The Mafia Island Marine Park is the first and largest marine park in sub-Saharan Africa.
It has some of the highest biodiversity of anywhere in the Indian Ocean. It has whale sharks. It's a very popular tourist destination. They just built the world's most expensive hotel. It's $10,000 a night.
Wow.
Yes. It's highly exclusive, and they renamed the island for the hotel, but the small little island off of Mafia where it's located. But it's magnificent, and people come from all over the world. Some people have called it the second best dive site in the world. The marine park was implemented in 1997, 1998, and as a result of marine park restrictions, they no longer allow men to fish in Mafia Island. And in a little island that I work on in Mafia Island, which is just like south of the island, but it's part of the Mafia Island Marine Park, it's a place where there's around 2,000, 2,500 people, and they have no running water. They are only able, because it's fossilized coral rocks, so they're only able to get water to survive from rain and rain collection. They also have no arable land. So because it's fossilized coral rock, again, it's impossible to grow crops. So their only means of subsistence, their only way to survive is from fishing by men, and then seaweed farming and octopus collection and, you know, small shell clam collection by women. So with these marine park restrictions for these men unable to fish now, all of the means of survival is premised on women's ability to farm seaweed. And that's caused a lot of havoc in the villages. They now have Mafia Island, despite it being this, you know, beautiful marine resource with plentiful fish and a beautiful place to live, it now has one of the highest malnutrition rates of anywhere in the world. And this is some work that was done by Vicky Moshi at the University of Dar es Salaam, who revealed that. And so when I asked the villagers in Mafia Island and on this little island, Jibondo, that I was talking about, you would ask them, what is the biggest threat to your life? And you would think they would say, well, not having fresh water or not having the ability to farm. And instead, they said it's the marine park because of these restrictions on fishing and the havoc that it's caused to their lives. And so as a response, women got together on their own without outside support to learn how to farm seaweed. And so seaweed farming was introduced to Tanzania many years ago as a development initiative, and it was facilitated and implemented by a beautiful and wonderful and amazing scholar named Narman Jidawi at the Institute of Marine Sciences in Zanzibar, who helped cultivate this now growing livelihood amongst all women along the coast of Tanzania to provide them with a needed income. So seaweed farming is interesting. A lot of people don't realize that seaweed's in everything. So it if you look at your chocolate milk, if you look at some of your cosmetics, if you look at your toothpaste, you will see carrageenan listed on it. And carrageenan is extracted from seaweed. And so you're actually eating seaweed all the time, but you might not know it. And Tanzania now is the fourth largest exporter of raw seaweed. And in terms of the global market, seaweed is very valuable as refined carrageenan, the powder that actually goes into making cosmetics, to making drugs. They're finding that seaweed might help prevent Alzheimer's. It's everywhere, and it's fascinating. And it's also now heralded as one of the superfoods. You eat seaweed, you can live forever. It's exciting. So while Tanzania is the fourth largest exporter of raw seaweed, there is not a processing facility in Tanzania. So the global market price for refined carrageenan, the powdered carrageenan, is about $100 around, it, give or take, for 1 kilogram. However, the global price for raw seaweed that's just dried is about 30 cents.
That's a big difference.
That's a very big difference.
Is that just because it takes so much energy and time and labor to...
If Tanzania built a processing facility, they could reap these kinds of profits. But that hasn't happened yet, interestingly.
Yeah.
And so this is an initiative that I would call out to the public to look into, and corporations to invest in seaweed processing facilities. I think it would be wonderful. I think it's much needed. And that's where you see an initiative that could be so wonderful, because seaweed farming, not only is it in everything we eat, it's actually farmed in a way that's 100% sustainable. So what women do is you go and collect seaweed that's already growing in the ocean, and you take it and you put it on a long line and you break it up into small pieces, and then you just let the ocean do the work itself. And the tide coming in and out feeds the seaweed, and it grows all on its own.
So are you...
Yeah.
Like, you're kind of... taking little seaweed seedlings?
Absolutely.
Or just chunks of seaweed?
Yeah, and little chunks of seaweed, which, you know, kind of mimic a seedling in a way.
Okay.
And then the ocean does the work itself, the tides.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, and they use plastic bottles to make it float.
Oh.
Yeah, so they're recycling any use of plastic bottles in the Mafia Island Marine Park and along the coast. And so these women get together, they farm the seaweed, they cultivate it, and then they have to bring it into shore when it's ready to be harvested. And this is tricky for them because seaweed is very heavy when you carry it, wet seaweed. And so it's hard on their backs. They also get some problems with their eyesight from being in the water with the reflection so much. So I'm always looking for a company interested in donating sunglasses. And but this is our way for them to make money. And so the women have figured out how to form collectives. And so they will store and pool the seaweed together until the market price goes a little bit up. And then they'll sell that on the global market. So it's 100% sustainable in terms of its farming practice, which is rare for agriculture or aquaculture in this case. It's a tool of economic empowerment for women, which is very important given their need for income and the work that they have to do in order to help their families survive. And then lastly, it also helps save our planet from climate change. Seaweed sequesters carbon. So it's really a triple win, you know. And so the project that I'm working on is called Building a Blue Seaweed Economy in Tanzania. There's all these discussions about a blue economy and what that would look like. And I think seaweed is a really fascinating one to do in Africa, in Tanzania, with these women. So we can empower them to have a livelihood and economic security. We can do a farming method, an aquaculture farming method that's sustainable. And we can also mitigate climate change.
There are a few factors that lately are making it harder for these women to do their jobs. Two of these are ocean warming and falling sea levels. You heard that right. Unlike most of the world, the waters around coastal Tanzania are not rising. They're dropping.
Because of plate tectonic activity in the Great Rift Valley, the continental shelf is experiencing uplift. And so because of that uplift along the coast, the sea level is actually falling. And the only reason that we know this is from the work of Ian Bryson, who's at the Norwegian University of Life Sciences, Vicky Moshi, again, who's at the University of Dar es Salaam, working with these women and revealing that women were describing sea level falling and the trouble that that was causing for them to farm the more valuable seaweed, which is capoficus. And what's even more interesting, and I'm writing a paper about it right now, is that the Tanzanian state, with donor funding, they just spent $8 million for climate change to build seawalls against a sea that is falling. Because the narrative, you know, the stories about sea level rise are so prolific that no one's questioning that it couldn't be happening.
So it's not that in this one place in the world the ocean is dropping.
No, and it's interesting. It's also happening in Norway, on the coast of Norway and other places. But because everyone's so worried about climate change, they're not willing to question some of the climate science.
Yeah.
So what this paper does, it traces why? Why did we spend $8 million on a problem that isn't happening?
Oh, they've already spent that.
Oh, it's done.
And they built the wall.
And they built the walls.
Okay.
And they built them coincidentally in the wealthiest part of the country.
Yeah.
To protect very important offices and residences who are experiencing erosion, mostly as a result of cutting out mangrove forests and doing development in places that they shouldn't be doing development. In the name of climate change.
So they assume that the erosion was because of sea level rise.
Well, it's not that they assume it. It's very convenient. It's a convenient truth, isn't it?
Yeah.
Let's just call it sea level rise. We can fix this problem. This is great. It's a win for us. It's a win for those elite for which that policy was driven towards. And again, this is why we need to have people who are on the front lines, poor people living on the front lines, working with these environments, trying to survive, to have a place at the negotiating table. And what I like to say is, if you don't have a seat at the table, you're often on the menu. Isn't that correct? So I think these women should have a voice. I'd like to see that happen at these COP, you know, COP conferences. I think that'd be amazing to get some of these women from coastal Tanzania up there talking. Just get a translator. It's really easy. And to have them have a space at the table and be able to talk about these issues, because we'd be able to understand the science a lot more, I think, and it would be really meaningful. And actually, their knowledge of these ecologies is sometimes and oftentimes more progressive than the scientific literature, because they have such a profound insight when you work with an environment, you know, over centuries. And I always relate this to tobacco farming in Kentucky. So I'm in Kentucky, and we have a history of tobacco farming, not as much today as before, but tobacco farming, from what I understand, is one of the hardest crops to farm. And you can't even read it from a textbook necessarily. It's centuries of knowledge passed down from generation to generation about how to do it well. So it's similar in these environments where people have lived for centuries. And I just wish that that knowledge was prioritized more and listened to more. And not only by scholars, but by the, you know, conservation organizations working in these places and the Tanzanian state. And so that's what my research is really focused on.
How often do you go every year over the last 20 years? How much time do you spend?
Before having children, it was a lot more. And I try to go at least once a year, you know, and I often Skype with my research participants. You know, WhatsApp is great. Staying in touch is really important. So you're not just this like scholar coming in, working in this place, and you disappear, you know. And I think that's what's been important to my own work, is having a history with these people so they know that you're always coming back.
Yeah.
And you're always giving your research results back, and you're always informing them of what's going on. And so I just presented this Building a Blue Seaweed Economy at a climate conference that we organized in Tanzania. And it was fascinating because I had the PowerPoint presentation, and then a villager came from Mafia. And I made printouts and then sat with him and explained everything that I said in this presentation so that he could go back to Mafia. He could tell the women, she's still fighting for you, right? So that they are aware that we are trying the best we can to have their voice heard. And I think that the villagers really appreciate that, and I appreciate that. And a close relationship is the key to learning, you know, their wisdom and having them trust you and want to talk to you and feel safe in that space.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Do you have a great idea for stopping climate change? We want to hear it. There aren't any silver bullets for fighting climate change. There isn't any one technology that's going to pull all of the excess carbon out of the atmosphere. A lot of people say we need to quit arguing about silver bullets and focus on silver buckshot, a lot of partial solutions. Actually, we probably need a whole silver artillery barrage. Anyway, you get the point. It doesn't have to be the only idea or the best idea, just something you think someone should be doing. If you'd like to share an idea, please go to howtostopclimatechange.com and record a quick voice message about it. We'll pick an idea to share and discuss it in each episode. When you first got to the country and nobody knew you, there must have been some crazy challenges.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I was this young woman and I was white and I didn't speak the language. And, you know, luckily I had no fear, you know, and so I was able to go to these places. And, you know, one of my research sites is in the largest mangrove forest in sub-Saharan Africa. And it's really hard to get to. You have to take a car and then you have to take a boat and it's incredibly remote and you can't even get there in the rainy season. And the people there are very hesitant of outsiders. So it's hard to make friends, you know. And living there is also quite difficult. It's muddy. It's mangroves. There's lots of mosquitoes. It has the highest malaria rates in the continent, really. And yet, it's a beautiful place, you know, with beautiful people who are working really hard to survive. And what's interesting about working in these places is that some of the biggest threats to their life aren't the realities of just living in these places. It's by external interventions that are ill-conceived, you know. And so we have this marine park, which is wonderful, and tourists come and they get so excited. And, you know, it's life-changing for them to swim with a whale shark. But what they don't realize is that because in the United States, we've created national parks, right? So we have Yellowstone. And Yellowstone, before we lived in it, Native Americans did. And Native Americans, they did prescribed burning and they managed the forest very well. And then we decided that that should be a space of national pride. And so we created a national park from it. And we removed any Native Americans from being able to live there. And what we did then was we created Smokey the Bear, where we said right, nobody can burn anything anywhere ever. And now Yellowstone is a tinderbox. Had we just talked to these Native American people, listened to their wisdom, and then built management strategies alongside of that, think about what that would be, right? We wouldn't have Smokey the Bear, which would be sad for some kids, but it'd be really good for the trees.
Yeah.
And in the same applies to Tanzania, you know, the Serengeti. Everybody loves the Serengeti. And I've taken students there, and they're mesmerized, and they tell me it's just like, you know, the Lion King. It was everything they thought it would be. And they're really happy, and they don't see people. And they expect that. They expect it to be like Yellowstone. No people. You're going out into nature. But people in Tanzania, they don't have the luxury of going to Kroger or Walmart or wherever to get their food. They have to use these resources to survive. And Serengeti, like Yellowstone, the cattle grazing by the Maasai warriors in the Serengeti was actually very good for the environment. It kept the acacia trees down so that you could see the vast expanses of the Serengeti that every tourist wants to see. And we colonialists and kind of, you know, this legacy evicted them forcefully and then stopped grazing. And guess what? The trees started growing back. So now they have foresters and other kinds of national park rangers coming in and cutting down the trees so that tourists can see what the Maasai have done for centuries, you know, the landscape that they expect to see. And I think that needs to change in sub-Saharan Africa, where we go to these places and we don't expect them to be like Yellowstone, that we see people using the land because they can do it sustainably and they are doing it sustainably. And that that's just a part of nature and what we should be experiencing. So in the Mafia Island Marine Park, the men who fish there have an amazing plethora of knowledge of how to fish, and they fish in certain seasons. They make sure that they have points by which they don't fish and periods of time so that the fish can regenerate. But instead, of course, we took this Yellowstone model. We created a national park, a marine park, where no fishing is allowed. And now these people are starving, you know. And so I've asked students when they've come to these national parks and marine parks, I said, how would you feel if you saw a person grazing their cattle while you were looking for a lion kill? Or how would you feel if you were swimming with a whale shark and saw someone fishing next to you? And they all said they didn't want that. They wanted to go out in nature and not see people. And so that is the biggest challenge, I think, facing conservation today, is that we really need to rethink it, and we need to think it with people included and actually see the productive ways in which they use and understand and manage their own environments.
That's kind of an interesting perspective, because they are there being people in the natural setting, being tourists, which in fact are some of the most disruptive people that could be in the landscape.
Absolutely. So one of my colleagues,
very unfortunate and selfish.
I know. One of my colleagues, who is one of the smartest people I know, Ian Bryson, he just created a documentary film with our research grant. And in the film about the marine parks in coastal Tanzania, he has a shot of a tourist crushing a coral reef with his foot, you know, and the ecological footprint of that, whereas we're demonizing these fishers who actually help promote biodiversity from their fishing. Yeah.
And maybe it's just, so far outside the realm of possibility for a person from a Western country to think that humans could kind of, exist in concert with nature. And
And we've been disciplined to think that in order to be in nature, it has to be without people.
Yeah.
You know, this is the real, these are all the people, these are all the greats, you know, and that's the way that we've understood wilderness and the wild.
Right.
Is people.
Except for that one person that's there observing it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Doesn't make any sense.
Exactly. And I think, you know, it's easier to build these marine parks and restrict people than really look at our own consumption habits and, you know, the fact that actually the devastation on the world's ocean from fish decline is from our desire for seafood. If you watch the Olympics in Brazil, you know, they focused all on trees, and that we should just be planting trees all over the world to sequester our carbon. And so there was a strategy proposed for carbon forestry, where we could continue to emit carbon. And I'm saying we, meaning those of us living in the developed world and corporations and industry, and that hypothetically our carbon would be captured and sequestered in forests in the developing world. So we would pay poor, you know, disenfranchised groups, marginalized groups to plant more trees to protect their forests. And it would be a win-win strategy, one for the environment, one for economic development, and it would solve climate change. And everyone was very excited about this policy. However, what people forgot to think about was the fact that if you're living in a rural area of Tanzania, for example, and you need to cook your food every day, you don't have any energy to do so other than fuel wood from trees, and you don't have electricity. You have to cut down trees. And also, there's no grocery store. So you have to farm your own crops. They had to survive. And so how do you make a policy work where a person still has to cut down trees to survive? Are you going to promise them money in perpetuity to change their entire way of life? Are you going to build infrastructure for them to get electricity from non-fuel wood sources? Are you going to, you know, create a grocery store so that they can go there to get their food and not farm it? And these were the complicated things that people kind of forgot to think about.
And if you did all those things, they would have to buy carbon offsets from somebody else.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it didn't quite work, you know, as well as one would hope. And yet when you buy something on Etsy, for example, you know, this when you go to purchase, it says, do you want to offset your carbon, you know, impact by shipping this good from this seller to you? Just pay for the carbon credits and you'll be good to go, you know? And
guilt-free consumption.
It's great. Yeah, we can still consume. We can still do everything we want to do. And people in the developing world who've had no stake in the game, they didn't cause this. So I think there are other strategies, and I was really excited to fall upon this research on building a blue seaweed economy in Tanzania because I actually believe in it. I think that it is a win-win-win. It's a win for the environment, it's a win for women, and it's a win for mitigating against climate change.
So you've spent pretty much all of your career up to this point kind of working on these issues that are very closely connected to climate change and the environment in general, and also society and inequality. What would you say to somebody who is a student now that wanted to go into one of those areas and make a difference in the world?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I could just speak from my own personal experience, you know, and one is invest in people when you work in a place, you know, and I think that if you really want to understand and learn, you need to invest yourself into that space. So wherever you want to do research, you need to be able to trust and have respect for the people who live there, you know, and I always bring it back with students to themselves. How would you feel if someone came to your house and said, you know what, you can no longer have your backyard be this way. I'm going to tell you it has to be a different way. Or if they go to you and you've been studying your whole life to be a doctor, they say, you know what, you can't be a doctor anymore. You have to stop being a doctor and now you have to go work at, you know, McDonald's. How would you feel? You know, and I think a lot of the policies that have been created and implemented in the global south and in the developing world have very much been in that way, where it's been top down, it's been thought of by scholars and policymakers and those in the upper echelons of power. And so I think it's really important to go in and just ask people, what do you want us to study? What is the issue? What are the issues that you are facing and why? And then build from there. And I also think to just get involved. You know, I run this sustainability environment and sustainability studies program here, and it's been such a great joy to see my students be so passionate about wanting to save the planet. In Kentucky, which is, you know, a coal state, we have the fastest growing major because students are really, really committed to this idea that we need to do something, and we do need to do something now. And that is really inspiring, and they are our future, and they want to do it on the right terms. So they learn about, you know, privileging other types of knowledge, and they learn about ill-conceived policies and why those happen and how power gets infiltrated into policy and who gets to decide and how to really contest that. So it's my dream that these students go off and get these high-level jobs in international policy or even in Kentucky. I have one that wants to bring environmentalism to the Republican Party here in Kentucky, and I'm so excited about that.
Yeah, that's, you know? That would be fantastic.
So cool. And, you know, I think he might do it. He's super smart.
It's easy sometimes to get frustrated. You know, I talk to plenty of people that still don't believe in climate change.
Yeah.
And then I talk to other people that believe in it, mm-hmm. but they just take the, you know, they just say,
yeah,
we're done. It's all over. There's nothing we can do. Give up. I had a friend the other day that actually told me, David, I know you like that sustainability stuff, but you should just forget about that. We're done. Oh. It's all over.
Well,
but what's the point of that?
Well, like, didn't
I mean, we got to make some sort of an effort.
Yeah, but these were this was the same kind of rhetoric in the past when we had CFCs. I mean, think about, you know, the things that we've been able to overcome as a society. You know, there's a scholar, Ruth DeFries, who's at Columbia, and I always assign her readings to my students because she imagines a future based on the innovation that we've had in the past. We're smart. Mm-hmm. You know, and it will happen, you know, and I don't think in these doomsday hypotheses. I mean, I was just talking with a colleague earlier about biomimicry, and Walmart is flying, you know, using their global flight patterns, mimicking bird flight patterns to do it more sustainably so that they are able to get the goods from one place to another in less time using less carbon. I mean, you know, this field is booming, you know? Corporations are starting to invest in it. It's an exciting time. I think that
well, and
it's
the fact that this is that your environmental studies major is the fastest growing major at UK. In
well,
the
not
of the
maybe
state.
Not at UK because you know, but in the College of Arts and Sciences.
Okay,
so but that
that's impressive.
It is, and we're in Kentucky. You know, this state that everyone perceives as being, you know. probably not like California or something when it comes to the environment. It doesn't matter, you know?
Well, yeah. I mean, we have a Friends of Coal license plate that you can get.
Yes. So. Yes, we do. And, you know, a lot of my students come from areas that have been devastated by the environmental impacts of the coal industry. But they also have, you know, there's a tension there because they have a respect for it because it provided a needed livelihood for them. So what can we do in that context? And so I always say when I'm speaking with my students here in Kentucky, I sympathize with that. I mean, my grandmother came from coal, you know, and in West Virginia and grew up in it. And so that's important, you know, to ensure people have a livelihood, but on whose terms and how we do that is really complicated. But we have a lot of students who want to figure that out.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode of How to Stop Climate Change, please give us a review or share the show with a friend. If you'd like to support the show, please head over to howtostopclimatechange.com/support. All donations will go to cover expenses and help me pay my daughter, Keaton, for all the time she spends editing and producing the show. I couldn't do this without her.
Music for today's episode was done by Avery Reedy, The Blueberries, Kiki and the Vets, and Paige Hugalay. Our theme music is by Juices.